This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello and welcome to Trumpet Hour this Friday, May 17th. I'm your host, Philip Nice, with our Philadelphia Trumpet writers. We have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
He's a contributing editor for the Philadelphia Trumpet, which goes to the printer today. We're finishing that up and doing pre-press and sending that out literally as we speak over on the other side of the building here at the Trumpet offices in Edmond, Oklahoma. But over there with Mr. Palmer at our office in Edstone, England, is Mihailo Zekic.
Hello.
He's got an article in the latest Trumpet that you'll want to check out, a trend article on Iran and its nuclear weapon. We also have here in studio with me, Andrew Miller.
Hello.
Hello, Andrew. And joining us from Zimbabwe this week, substituting for Jeremiah Jacques, is Rifaro Manyepa.
Hello.
He's a contributor for thetrumpet.com and the Trumpet print edition. And this week in Edmond, we are having quite an exciting series of events. May has just been chock full of recitals and all manner of end of semester events, including final exams. I know Andrew has a chemistry final to grade. I've got a journalism final. Mr. Palmer just mentioned that he's got work to do for international relations and Old Testament survey. It's all about education here in Edmond and there in Edstone, England this week as the Herbert W. Armstrong College and Imperial Academy school years come to an end. And in all these events and these festivities and families being proud of their graduates and picnics and parties at the elementary school and so forth, a lemonade stand, all these events going on everywhere you look, you just see in that this is how to build families. This is how to build society. This is how to build nations. And it takes a right education, a slow and strong and solid building at the family level to solve some of the problems that we discuss here on Trumpet Hour in international relations, in international conflicts. Those do get down to the family level and the individual education level. So it's refreshing, I'll just say, to be in the midst of a lot of things moving in the right direction in terms of building the family, building education. And that is, in fact, what you build nations on, the education of its citizens. But as I say, here on Trumpet Hour, we focus on world events and mostly on international world events. We're going to start this week with Europe. Mr. Palmer, you monitor Europe. Can you give us a rundown of the top stories from that region?
Yes, Germany is making national and collective defense its priority, which is a first since the Second World War. The German Defense Minister Boris Pistorius gave a quite remarkable speech on May 9th, where this was a much more overt, we're developing our military and we're proud of it speech. There weren't really any new announcements per se in terms of Germany doing things to its military, but we have an article up on our website, or will very shortly, from Joshua Michels that just does a great job of showing what a big deal that change in tone from this speech is and what it means that you have a Germany that is assertively proud of its military and kind of not at all hiding the fact that it is having a major revamp here. Then also in the Netherlands, after 6 months, they finally have a government. We don't actually know who the prime minister is going to be. That is yet to be revealed. So I guess things are still going to chug on for a little bit longer. But we do have a much more dramatically right-wing government than we would have seen in modern European politics. It's going to be kind of half politicians, half technical experts. The biggest winner of the election, Geert Wilders, he's not going to be prime minister. The other parties refuse to back him, but he has gotten a lot of policies in there where he promised yesterday it's going to have the strictest ever asylum policy for the Netherlands, that the Netherlands is going to opt out of EU rules on immigration. There was a lot on farming reforms. You know, there's a halt on a lot of environmental policies and farm shutdowns and things like that that really did push Wilders and others to great heights of success. The embassy is going to move in Jerusalem from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem in Israel. So you know, they're making very clear where they stand on that issue. And I think it's always interesting whenever we're covering the Dutch politics, because I have a lot of respect for Geert Wilders. And I think he has a lot of courage and he has stood up to and articulated problems, not just with radical Islam, but even with Islam itself, in the, with the Quran, in a way that others just haven't dared, even at risk of his own life. You know, Dutch politicians have been killed for saying what Geert Wilders has said. So there's a lot to be impressed about there. But we're here to analyze in the light of Bible prophecy. And the trend that we're watching for from the Bible is Europe to shift in this more authoritarian direction. And you can absolutely see this shift in the Netherlands. As good as individual policies or individual leaders might be, does play a part in that much more dangerous trend. And that's something also that I think the main story today will play a major part in.
Right. That situation in the Netherlands also just another example of this kind of gridlock that many European nations are suffering. It taking them a long time to get that coalition together. Still not totally sure who the head of government is going to be. And we've been watching that as a trigger, if you will, that will cause Europe to basically shake off a lot of the things that limit it, that cause the gridlock. So that's another example of that. But yes, I wanted to lead with this topic that you submitted on the outline here, and it's quite ominous.
It is. I don't remember ever talking on Trumpet Hour about the head of a modern European country coming close to being assassinated. It is definitely not part of your run-of-the-mill story. So the Slovakian Prime Minister, Robert Fico, there was a cabinet meeting, he was greeting well wishers out in the public, and then he was shot 5 times with a handgun, one bullet going into his stomach. Of course, because of the age of social media, generally, if you've got a politician out there shaking hands, someone's going to have a smartphone out. And sure enough, this was all captured on video. It's a pretty shocking video. It's all up there online. In the hours afterwards, we didn't know whether he was going to survive or whether he was going to die. It seemed like he's pulled through. Probably the danger zone is over, so it seems likely he is going to recover. But certainly a very dramatic event to have a world leader almost killed.
Right, a sitting head of government of a European nation. And as you said there, I think the whole world is kind of on edge for what happens if this starts, right? What happens if all the absolute vituperative anger and hatred and evil finally erupts, finally breaks out, and people say, well, the solution is to just kill the guy? There could be no end to that. I think everybody is terrified of what this could lead to, not necessarily this assassination, but it's certainly, as I say, ominous.
Yeah, I mean, you put it in context to say the political violence that we're seeing within Germany that I think I mentioned right in the kind of the quick rundown last week, where you're having people putting up posters, or local politicians standing for election. And I think the takeaways from this, in terms of how, like, you're absolutely right, this has gotten everybody on edge. We don't know why he was shot yet. So it's got a lot of people on edge regardless. But how this story develops, I think, will depend a lot on why he was shot. And it's an odd kind of backstory. The shooter is a poet. He's a member of a writing society, or he founded a literary society over there. He's part of the Slovakian Writers Association or something like that. He founded a political movement the Movement Against Violence, it's called. And he had several articles 7-8 years ago about the dangers of violence in politics. So a anti-violence in politics advocate is not your usual suspect for shooting a prime minister. It's really hard to know, I think, what's going on there. There are potentially local issues that are kind of unique to Slovakia. Robert Fico has kind of shady links to the mafia. So is that something that's playing into this? Threats of political violence is uniquely high in Slovakia. I think we see it rising everywhere, but this is a country that is 50% rural. There are quite a lot more guns in the country, this kind of thing. There has been more talk, aggressive talk on both sides of the political spectrum. Maybe that plays into it. I think it's too early, though, to really say, well, this is why or that is why. And I think we have seen some outlets jump to that, but there's nothing to give us anything to go on. And that's why I think the main takeaway at this point is you know, a lot of leaders are going to be seeing, well, regardless of what the local situations are, there are similarities in my country. And, well, what do we need? How do I stay safe? How do we keep our politicians? How do we stop my own politicians being attacked? And I think a lot of those fears are genuine. And maybe it's different in different countries. But you look at Britain, where we've been talking about Parliament changing its procedure because of fears of a Muslim mob outside. You had a British MP killed by a Muslim attacker. Now, that seems a very different. I don't think there's any suggestion that that's a case in FICO, that this is radical Islam or anything like that. But still, you've got politicians in danger. And that is going to lead to more cries for surveillance, more cries for political censorship. You know, we were talking about this last time, where you had someone in Germany fined 6,000 euros for citing government statistics. Well, if the problem is deemed to be violent rhetoric within politics, well, what's going to happen? Then you're going to have criminalization of speech. Hate speech is violence, this kind of thing. So I think there's certainly a lot of different ways that this could push Europe in a dangerous direction.
Right. I would beg to differ that there is absolutely, like, it's too early to even get an indication. Maybe you've seen something that I haven't. But after the shooting happened, there was a video circulating of this, of the guy that shot him, Juraj Cintula, I believe his name is pronounced, speaking about the government going after Slovakian media, saying that they're liquidating the media. And if you, for longtime listeners that have followed Mr. Palmer's previous coverage on Poland and how they were liquidating basically their state broadcaster unconstitutionally, that kind of thing. Slovakia is literally going through the exact same thing right now, only in this case, it's the populists that are doing it against a more liberal-leaning media outlet. Again, in the age of deep fakes and artificial intelligence, it's a bit hard to verify if this is a case. And one video is not going to like be the smoking gun that answers all the questions. But when you have a government led by, like what Mr. Paul mentioned, a guy that has links to the mafia, a guy that has links to Vladimir Putin, doing things like liquidating state media and, in Robert Fico's case, replacing it with a mouthpiece for him and his policies, like, people are genuinely scared. People are genuinely scared on what's going to be the future. Are we going back to, this is Eastern Europe, are we going back to dictatorship days? But for too many people, again, I don't know if what Cintula's motives are. Nobody knows at this point. But if his idea on how to fix the problem is, well, if Hitler's in power, the solution is to kill Hitler, you basically have two pressures from both sides, basically undoing this prosperous, relatively stable order. And as Mr. Palmer was mentioning, if the powers that be, including maybe some more, less scrupulous powers, look at this and go, okay, there's some pushback against us, some pretty violent pushback. This is a good excuse for us to push further. Think about the Nazis. Think about what was it that got Hitler in power? A big part of it was fear of communism. You see, like, communists tussling in the streets. The Reichstag was set on fire by a communist, most likely set up by the Nazi parties themselves. But still, people were looking, going, whoa, these guys are dangerous. We need to support Hitler. We need to let him start taking matters into his own hands, do things we wouldn't have agreed to just yesterday. And again, it's too early to tell, but who knows? This could be one of those Reichstag fire moments that some wannabe tyrants use to start getting more top-heavy pressure in their countries.
I mean, I wonder whether the Patriot Act is perhaps a better analogy than the Reichstag fire, in that I don't think I had a particularly strong objection to the Patriot Act. I don't think those of us that were around working here did. Because it was a genuine problem. Like, the Twin Towers had been destroyed. Radical Islam was a very real problem. And there were problems in surveillance, in the intelligence community, that, you know, there were things that needed to be fixed. And so, yeah, at the time, that seemed kind of a reasonable thing to do. In hindsight, we can now see, well, the Patriot Act, yeah, I think you can debate what an appropriate response is, but it certainly has enabled government agencies that have used that to have a huge degree of control over the American population. The things stemming from the Patriot Act that have been used to spy on the Trump campaign, that have been used to censor what's said on Twitter and things like that. So, you know, was the Patriot Act the right thing to do that was misused? Was it an overreaction? That's kind of a debate for another day. But certainly you've got something, a genuine problem, used then either at the time or subsequently by bad actors. And I think, I don't, like, there is a sitting leader of Europe has been assassinated. Like, I don't want to lose sight of, yeah, there is a problem. It's not like they're picking on a tenuous excuse to come up with a crackdown. But still, people can be motivated by a genuine fear and point to genuine problems and still come up with something that is going to lead to a more authoritarian direction. And then that's where, you know, from Bible prophecy, we know that this is leading. That's where we don't have to speculate. And this is something that we've been forecasting for a long, long time. Simon talks about this video, or Mihailo talks about this video more on his article that he's got on the website at the moment, Robert Fico and the Return of Europe's Ghosts, that really does both set up the full context of what is happening here. We will have to wait and see, I guess. Just I am probably too slow to call things these days in an era of deep fakes, especially as you have some people saying, well, actually, this guy was pro-Russian and there's some of that evidence, and some saying, well, no, he was pro-Ukrainian. We might have to just see a little bit on how some of the dust settles there. But the prophecy is absolute that we have there. And he goes through that and talks about Revelation 17, talking about a rise of 10 kings. And these are leaders that lead as kings. This is a Europe that enforces a certain religious identity, and it can punish its citizens if they deviate from that, which implies quite a big level of surveillance, quite a lot of control over its leaders. And certainly something that has all the leaders across Europe scared like that is going to be a major step towards that. And I could see potentially many other ways that this may well tie into Bible prophecy as we know more exactly around what the motivation of this individual does and see how Europe reacts.
And Europe's reaction is the main thing to watch. Again, on Trumpet Hour, we're looking at the end result. We're looking at what the Bible says will occur. And we're trying to connect the links of the chain from now till then. And we're trying to see how that's going to happen. But things are definitely getting more tenuous. Things are definitely getting more fraught in Europe. The gridlock continues, as we said. And now with Russia actually fighting in Eastern Europe and an ongoing war in Ukraine with political violence increasing, we're saying, as we've said for a few months now, that whatever you think, Europe is definitely changing. Europe is definitely in turmoil. And the Europe of 2025 is going to be markedly different than the Europe of 2024 and certainly of years past. The article Mr. Palmer mentioned there was Robert Fico and the Return of Europe's Ghosts. That's written by Mihailo Zekic, who you heard there as well. And in that article, he recommends Who or What is the Prophetic Beast? A booklet by Herbert W. Armstrong. Who or What is the Prophetic Beast? And you'll, again, find that at thetrumpet.com. Next, we go to Asia. Rufaro, you've been watching Asia in Jeremiah Jacques' stead this week. Can you give us a rundown of the top stories from that region?
Yes. First off, we can talk about China. Its economy is in trouble. Apparently, its Politburo is going to introduce some economic reforms to deal with, quote, risks and hidden dangers that it's finding in its economy. There are so many problems with the local government's debt. There are issues with financial growth in China itself. This has been building for a while, for the last few years, but it's pretty significant because, you know, not too long ago, China was the economy that everybody pointed to in the world, talking about rapid growth and all these impressive things that are happening. Now it's the opposite. Things are looking really concerning for China. Its Central Committee is holding a session in July that wasn't supposed to happen then, but it looks like they're going to be talking about some changes and reforms that they need to make in order to basically fix their economy. And the second story we're going to talk about is over in Russia. On Sunday this week, Russian President Vladimir Putin announced the removal of longtime serving Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu from his role. And this is really interesting because if you remember last year, that coup that was led by Yevgeny Prigozhin against Russia, it seemed, and it seemed at first as though it was against Vladimir Putin, but apparently was really about the failings that ousted Defense Minister Shoigu had in his conduct of Russia's defense forces in Ukraine. And it seems that now Putin has also decided that this fella needed to go. And so he's been replaced by the person who was serving as deputy prime minister all along. And this is now just a pretty clear sign of the intent that Putin has on making sure that this war in Ukraine ends up in a Russian victory. And both of these stories here, what's happening in Russia and what's happening in China, are, I think, pretty important as a backdrop to what we're going to be talking about as the main story today.
Yeah, and that main story did catch my eye, and it gets down to two particular powers, but two particular men at the head of those two super powerful nations. Tell us about your main story.
Right. Yeah, this happened just yesterday, but Vladimir Putin met with Chinese General Secretary Xi Jinping in Beijing yesterday, and it was a public showcase of just how strong the relationship is between these two. Again, it comes amidst the trouble with China's economy, what's happening in Russia's shakeup. It's actually interesting that Sergei Shoigu did attend this meeting as well with the new defense minister. And James Char of Singapore School of International Studies says that the very act of receiving Putin by Beijing on its own is already a form of support to Russia, since China is the sole major country left that has not isolated Moscow. This is a pretty big move. Russia has been isolated by most of the world, but China here is saying, come over, let's talk. And these two individuals themselves, you know, they've spoken about each other as, you know, best friends. They've said that there's no limits to the partnership. These are their words describing it. And so in a time of turmoil, for them to meet up in this way and have discussions like this, it's very significant. And we can hear a little bit more about that in this clip.
The Biden administration has already accused the Chinese government of materially supporting Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine. Now, when I say materially supporting, that's equipment, goods, which are being sent to Russia, apparently with a sort of a civilian use, but really which are being used to fuel the war. What this trip is all about is also providing Vladimir Putin with moral support. There he is. He's quite isolated on the world stage. He can't travel to many countries for fear of being arrested and sent to the International Criminal Court. Here, he can have a grand meeting in which he would appear to many of his own people to be, you know, more of a genuine, normal world leader than an international pariah.
So, as I was saying earlier, though, I think it really is important to think about the Chinese economy aspect to all of this. Again, you know, things aren't going very well for China. And a lot of people have been focusing, as we just heard, on how China is helping Russia, supporting it in real terms, and also the moral support it's offering. And, you know, I really kind of wish I could be a fly on the wall in the meeting that Xi and Putin would have had, because, you know, I think they would have spoken about Russia and its war effort, but I wonder how much was spoken about just China's own troubles and all the unspoken ways in which the relationship dynamics are shifting. You know, it initially would have seemed, you know, as China's just showing up and helping Russia for nothing in return, but Russia's been in this war for a long time. It's holding its own, and China's been helping it. China's got its own problems as well, and not a lot of people in the world and in the West trust China. How important is it for China to have someone like Russia, someone like Vladimir Putin, there in the corner offering support? And despite all of the problems they're having in the economy, I think that's probably an important dimension in this, and just how much Russia might start to feel like, even though China's had this great economy over the years, who really is the top dog, so to speak, in that relationship?
I think it's interesting. I believe this is the first foreign visit that Putin has made since securing his next presidential term. And that's always used to signal the priority with which one country assigns its relationship with the other countries. And after Xi secured his next term back in early 2023, Russia was the first place that he visited. I'm pretty sure that I've got that right. This is interesting because you talk about the economy, China with an economy that has probably surpassed the United States at this point. It's definitely stumbling, as you say. Russia with an economy more close to the size of Texas. And yet you make a very interesting point there when you say you'd like to be a fly on the wall and see the relationship dynamic between those two men in particular. What are you getting at here? It seems like, well, China's the superpower. They're Russia's only friend. What are you looking for there? Because we're looking for something in particular when we're looking for these news events. What are you looking for?
Right. So there's a lot that we don't know about the particulars of what's happening and how they view each other. But we watch for those particular changes based on what the Bible says. And in Revelation 16, it's pretty clear about a pretty huge Asian alliance that's prophesied to take shape in this modern era called the Kings of the East. And you look at passages in Ezekiel 38 and 39, they talk about how Russia and China are the major powers in that block. There are others who will be in there as well. But those scriptures are some that our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, has identified as describing Russia as the outright lead nation in the alliance. And that's why we look closely for these shifting dynamics to see how they're playing out. And Mr. Fleury has said a lot about it, and he said something in particular. He says that we've been proclaiming for over 50 years that Russia, China, and other Asian nations would ally themselves in the end time. And we are in that end time now. And I think, you know, as we come here and we talk about these things week to week, it's kind of easy to just take it for granted that these things are going to happen and that we've been saying it for so long. But this is so important to take a look at because these are the steps being taken to the full realization of these prophecies. We really have to pay attention to all these things because it is important. One day we'll wake up and all of a sudden there's that Asian bloc fully formed, Russia at the head. And it's easy to then say, where is this coming from? But it's been in the Bible all along. We've been talking about it, like Mr. Fleury said, for over 50 years. And these are the things we're watching for. These are the things that are so important to look at in order for us to know when that time comes. Okay, we knew this was coming. We didn't know exactly how it would happen. But this is what the Bible said would happen.
It's fascinating. And it's fascinating that, as you say, Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has specified not only Russia as a fulfillment of these entities that are described in the Bible, but Vladimir Putin's role specifically in that. And as you said, that this insistence that Russia will not only ally with China, but will actually lead China. And not only that, but Vladimir Putin will be the one to lead Russia. That's been his consistent assertion for about a decade now, that Vladimir Putin is going to fulfill a role that's written about in the Bible. And so you go back to the Bible, you look at these things, you realize these are forecasts for the future that either haven't occurred or will never occur, or they could be occurring right now. And you've got to match what the Bible says with what you're seeing around you, what the trumpet is forecasting, what we're looking for in these events, and why we will emphasize what seems to be a small part and not emphasize things that other news outlets are emphasizing in these relationships, because we are looking for this in particular. Is it right? Is it accurate? Is it true? First step to figuring that out is Russia and China and prophecy. To know where these scriptures are and how they relate the modern nations of Russia, the modern individual leading Russia, to prophecies that were written thousands of years ago. Our next region is the Middle East. Mihailo Zekic, you've been watching the Middle East. Can you give us just a quick rundown of the main events from that area?
Yes, the Houthis claim they struck two shipping targets in the Mediterranean. I emphasize the word claim because nobody can seem to tell what shipping they actually targeted. This may very well just be bluster on their part, but they have, as we talked about in this program before, threatened to do that. So that's something we're going to keep an eye on. Also, the International Atomic Energy Agency recently released its annual report to select audiences, mainly governments and those concerned about nuclear safety. Bloomberg got an exclusive preview, and in there, IAEA Chief Rafael Grossi mentioned that Iran has basically neutered the IAEA's inspection abilities to the point where they don't really have oversight, or at least regular continual oversight over, say, how the centrifuges are working and that kind of thing. And he admitted that we cannot guarantee that Iran's program is for sure for peaceful purposes. That might sound like a no story, but at the same time, the IAEA has been, for the most part, they have to be diplomatic in order to get Iran to let them put monitoring services in the first place. And as we've talked about again before on this program, we're seeing people like Grossi more and more call Iran out, use blunter language, use more open language, talking more openly about this kind of stuff, which suggests that they know something we don't. They know that Iran's a lot closer to nuclear breakout than we realize, and they're at the very least sounding the alarm while still trying to be as diplomatic enough as could be. And also on Monday, Israel, as they're cleaning through Gaza, they found a found some documents from Hamas claiming that Hamas has had plans in store to set up a secret base in Turkey once their base of operations in Gaza is done for. Hamas obviously has a very close relationship with Turkey and the Turkish government over there. The Turks have been letting their members have haven over there for a little bit, letting them use Turkish institutions for money transfers and that sort of thing. Whether this particular plan to actually physically relocate their base of operations to Turkey is known by President Erdogan or anybody else high up in the Turkish government at this point, we don't know. And it's unlikely the Turks are going to come clean about any details they know about that. But considering Turkey is technically one of the few Muslim countries, or at least Muslim countries in the Middle East, that still recognize Israel's right to existence and have diplomatic relations, you could fly between Istanbul and Tel Aviv, even if they're not on the friendliest terms, we do expect some of these more quote-unquote moderate countries to get a bit more involved with the Palestinian affairs to Israel's detriment.
So we've got Iran pushing ahead with its nuclear program in significant ways, the Houthis claiming to hit targets in the Mediterranean, and a Hamas secret base in Turkey. What tops each of those for your main story?
Well, in a sense, it's the Gaza war itself, because as I'm sure many of our listeners know, the Rafah invasion, it hasn't fully happened yet, but Israel is piece by piece getting more and more into this last little corridor they haven't fully established themselves in. They've taken the border crossing with Egypt. They're starting to shell the city. They've taken some of the outskirts. And the big question with this is what happens after? And this is a question that a lot of people in Israel are asking. This is a question that a lot of people in the world are asking. So start with, there's been an interesting article from the Financial Times claiming the U.S. is trying to get an Arab coalition together to govern Gaza after Israel finishes its invasion, which is what Israel wants. And supposedly certain countries like Morocco, like the UAE, they're actually listening and considering with it. All those countries already have relations with Israel. Yesterday, there was a summit of the Arab League. That's a pan-governmental organization that represents the Arab states from North Africa to the Persian Gulf. And they called for UN peacekeepers into Gaza to work, of course, towards a two-state solution, etc. I don't think Israel's going to listen to that too much. I don't think Israel likes the UN for certain reasons we seem to talk about over and over and over again on this radio program. But the fact that they're even suggesting an international coalition to come and do something in Gaza and not overtly demonize Israel and not like to, like, we need to war against the Jewish state and we need to support our Hamas brothers. That in and of itself is pretty groundbreaking. And considering a lot of these countries, as I mentioned, already have relations with Israel and are on friendly terms with Israel, this might be a veiled actual offer that Israel might consider. As far as Israel itself is concerned, this is taking a bit of a different turn in the sense that you have the some of the higher-ups in the army actually openly spatting with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, like Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, Army Chief of Staff Herzi Halevi. They made statements, public statements, basically accusing Netanyahu of incompetence and of mismanaging the war and of not having a proper day-after plan. Netanyahu himself has said that, well, first we'll finish the war, then we'll talk about a day-after plan. Netanyahu, of course, has a lot of a lot of enemies from people outside his coalition, from people inside his coalition, in this case, even people within his own party. He's a perennial survivor of people trying to oust him from leadership and manipulating things a little bit more. This could very well be one of those. But it goes without saying, now that Israel is approaching the conclusion of the war, there isn't much time left until that war is finished, hopefully, assuming they don't stall, or assuming the United States doesn't do some shenanigans or whatever. And that question is going to have to be answered. And Gallant for himself has stated he does not want an Israeli military control or civilian control under Gaza. Whether that's a good thing or not, that's up to the Israelis to decide at this point. But the fact that, and the fact that he's openly giving an ultimatum basically to his boss is obviously not good either. I highly doubt Netanyahu is going to stick his foot down too much on this. I mean, he's already been shopping around for people to try and intervene and do this kind of thing. And according to the U.S., according to some of these Arab groups, it's basically a message saying we're ready. We're ready. There's obviously some polishing that has to be done, and they don't want to look like they're siding with Israel too much. But we could very well see an international force come into Gaza and start governing it very soon. And the reason I wanted to bring this up is there's a prophecy in the 83rd Psalm, which speaks of an end time alliance that's meant to go after Israel and that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance. That's in verse 4. It speaks of a bunch of peoples that have never done this in history. That's why our editor-in-chief, Mr. Fleury, has pointed to this being a prophecy. And it includes the ancestral peoples of a lot of what we would call the moderate Arabs, like the Gulf Arab states, like Jordan, like some of these countries that Israel has been making relations with. And crucially, it includes the Philistines, which Mr. Fleury has pointed to meaning the Palestinians, Gaza. In other words, Gaza is going to be allied with the moderate Arabs, with Europe, as the prophecy also mentions. And that's basically exactly what these groups are offering on a platter right now. Israel doesn't know it. Israel doesn't think that it's a bad thing. But that's what's in the works right now, and that's most likely what's going to happen. If our listeners would like to learn more as to why we think this, how this is developing in other ways, and what it leads to in the future, Mr. Fleury has written a book we refer to time and time again, The King of the South. That's The King of the South. I can explain that and a lot more.
Once again, that's The King of the South. Read that. Look at Psalm 83 and be able to ask yourself in an informed manner, do these words in the Bible, Edom, Moab, Gibeah, Ammon, Amalek, Philistines, do these actually correspond to something in our lifetimes? And are they properly, accurately explained by The Trumpet and by Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury? If so, that is extremely significant. It's a huge claim to make, but you're going to have a look at it. You're going to have to decide for yourself whether this message that really is unique to The Trumpet, enormous amount of prophecy in the Bible, very few churches get into that, and those who do are frequently wrong for obvious reasons. Is this explanation of a specific Bible prophecy, tying it to specific nations and specific imminent events, accurate? Read The King of the South by Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury at thetrumpet.com/literature. Our last region is Anglo-America. Andrew Miller, before you get that chemistry final graded, you're going to give us an update on Anglo-America.
Wildfires are spreading throughout Western Canada. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services has suspended all federal funding to EcoHealth Alliance for its role in creating the COVID-19 pandemic. And the New York Federal Reserve's quarterly report on household debt and credit reports that nearly 1 in 5 American credit card holders have maxed out their cards.
We've had several troubling bits of news about the average American's financial situation. And you mentioned about the collapse of the bank there in Philadelphia area, I think it was. And I'm seeing more headlines about the debt and people's spending habits and the government's spending and inflation. And it's the United States is at a very dangerous juncture financially. But let's get into the main story that you think is worth dwelling on from Anglo-America.
Yeah, the main story is something that's really revolutionary, not just in Anglo-America, but actually around the world. And that's the way that artificial intelligence is supercharging the threat of election fraud and even election theft. Now, this week, this has kind of gotten in the news because there were some deep fakes released made with AI software of Donald Trump meeting with Jeffrey Epstein, which never happened. It's all AI generated, but pretty realistic looking. They took some polls, and actually about 3/4 of Americans, a little over about 78% of Americans polled, said that they're worried that artificial intelligence is going to affect the 2024 presidential election this fall. So the billionaire financier George Soros has generously decided to donate $80 million of money to the cause of fighting disinformation and AI fraud. And I guess I phrased that like he just decided this week, but this is the money he's spent over several years for this cause. This is a cause he's been looking at for a long time. Although ironically, looking into it, you'll find that the threats to combat artificial intelligence in elections are actually, you're fighting fire with fire. You're using artificial intelligence to combat artificial intelligence and making an even bigger threat to the election. Now, another thing that happened this week is there's actually about 200 organizations penned a letter to the big tech companies requesting that they fight artificial intelligence fraud. And it's about 45 of those organizations that have received, if you tally it all up, the $80 million from George Soros. So that's where that number comes from. But these 200 organizations, they're specifically requesting that the big tech companies do what they did last election and censor fake news stories using not just like with a person there behind a computer censoring, but actually write artificial intelligence algorithms that would mimic the type of decisions that a liberal person would make to censor those out automatically. And so you're looking like this, and I don't think too many people are concerned that whatever guy made the Trump Epstein picture with an AI software is going to like totally overturn the next election. I mean, that stuff like that is concerning that can be done now. But the idea that you're getting Wall Street financiers giving millions of dollars to 200 organizations to lobby the big tech companies to make algorithms that automatically censor that type of thing and a bunch of other stuff out does revolutionize how elections were held. I think this is taking it to a whole new level. But even last election, I pointed out Dr. Robert Epstein, no relation to Jeffrey Epstein, but a behavioral psychologist who pointed out that 86% of all internet searches in the world happen on Google. And of those 86%, 95% of the website you click on comes up on the Google first page. So 95 of 85 is about 81 point something percent of all internet searches come from the first page of Google. And so if a company like Google can write an algorithm that will censor conservative information and promote liberal information, like these 200 groups in alliance with George Soros are recommending they do, you can make it to where, yeah, like 8 in 10 people are never even exposed to conservative opinions. Robert Epstein estimates that he felt in 2020 that a bare minimum of 6 million votes were shifted to Joe Biden using that technology. And it's not outright election fraud. It's not like you stole 6 million ballots, but like 6 million people cast a legitimate ballot for Joe Biden that they may not have had they been exposed to stories like the Hunter Biden laptop and other things that were censored from that first page of Google. And so they're using issues like this deep fake as kind of their excuse that, well, the big tech companies need to get involved. But then they use artificial technology to basically automate the process to where with the Twitter files, you could see something like an FBI agent like, oh, we didn't like that tweet about the Hunter Biden laptop. Could you please take it down? And then you have to have a Twitter employee come in and take it down. That's natural. Well, it's not very much intelligence, but you're using your natural intelligence to go in there and remove that tweet. But now you're trying to like standardize it where you've actually got like an algorithm that the AI is advanced enough that the computer can read the tweet know that it's conservative and take it down itself. Or I guess Elon Musk is trying to kind of make that happen less on Twitter, but like YouTube, Google, Discord, Instagram, TikTok, all these other things that you've actually got it like literally programmed into the system to tell people what you want them to know. And of course it takes like, yeah, the like liberal programmers to put it in there. But and some of it is just shocking the level they, one personal example I can think of, it was on the Trumpet Daily maybe 2 years back, Mr. Stephen Fleury, he'd read a quote about like the communist plot to destroy the nuclear family. And it was written from, it was a well-written article, but it was written on a blog. And so not mainstream. So, but he had it up on the Trumpet Daily screen. And I was doing some research on it where I needed the exact quote and what, and a little bit more. So I didn't know what website he got it from. I could just see the quote on the Trumpet Daily screen. So I put quotation marks in and wrote the quote and put it into Google. And because it had quotation marks, like it came back like your search not found. Like we searched all the websites on the internet.
Yeah.
And like, this is not a real quote. And so I was thinking, like, well, maybe I spelled something wrong. But then I was like, what I ended up doing is I just ended up copying, paste that quote into Yahoo News, and it was the top hit.
Interesting.
So it's like Google had pretty much taken that article on the communist destruction of the family and made it so you could not find it. I spent like half an hour. You could not find it using the Google search algorithm. You had to use another, like, of that 14% of web traffic that's not Google-based, probably most of that's Yahoo, which is actually biased itself, but not as bad. So you had to know specifically what you're looking for. So you could see if you're just a casual web browser going through Google, you're not finding anything about the communist destruction of the family.
Yeah, I think what's important to also remember, like, with all of the descriptions that Andrew's just given of this technology and how good it is already, like, there's so much time and money being invested in improving artificial intelligence. Like, where it is today is basically, you can say it's as bad as it's ever going to be. It's only going to get better at filtering any information that the people who are creating it don't want to be out there, recognizing, you know, not even some things that are overtly a tweet written by Ben Shapiro, for example, like just dripping with modern day conservatism, but just, you know, a regular person who has a vestige of Judeo-Christian values in his life and them saying anything that might even resemble that, like it's going to get so good that it can just whitewash all of the internet and discern everything. Like, so much investment is going on into improving this. And some of it, you know, right now you see, for example, it's a bit of a different realm, but just the videos that are produced by AI, the audios, like if you really pay attention, you can kind of tell like a little, you can still tell a little bit that it's AI, but very soon it's going to be indiscernible. And the same as well for these algorithms that they're developing in order to be able to just wipe out anything they want on the internet. The technology is only going to get better than what it is now.
No, that is true. It's only getting better. And like I mentioned at the beginning, this is the ideal way to rig an election. Because if you hack a computer to change the vote tally, which happens sometimes, or if you stuff a fraudulent ballot or you get an illegal immigrant to vote, you're putting junk ballots into the system. And there's always a chance that, like, if you investigate that thoroughly enough, that you'll be able to find the junk ballot. But if you can use artificial intelligence algorithms in media to basically make citizens of a country decide to vote a certain way, then their vote is legitimate. So it's like you haven't actually stolen the election. You've rigged it by influencing behavioral science, but it's still a threat to democracy, because even though like technically the people are voting, if the people are voting based on the information bubble that the elites have created for them, the elites still control the system. A lot of these, I mean, George Soros and these left-wing networks that are doing this, they all, if you trace it back, they all kind of revolve around Barack Obama, which is why in our editor-in-chief's book, America Under Attack, identifies Barack Obama as an end-time type of King Antiochus Epiphanes from ancient history, who in the book of Daniel is prophesied to cast truth to the ground. And so this type of activity is like the quintessential example of how you'd cast truth to the ground in the modern day, where you're promoting opinions that in many cases are just blatantly unfactual, but you've got the full power of the tech companies at your disposal to, like I said, prevent people from even finding out the other side of the debate and completely censoring it. And so you're not just like stealing ballots, but you're actually like blotting out a belief system of the people, which is the best way to like fundamentally transform a nation in a way that's basically irreversible.
The battle there is for the mind. You know, I think an everyday person, an everyday American, everyday listener, just going about your business, you completely underestimate how important you are, that you are the objective, you are the target. And this is one example of that, influencing an election, as you say. But I mean, even better than installing a president who you want into a constitutional system is controlling people's, not only their votes, but their actions and their behaviors and their minds by what you're able to manipulate. And we're not talking about sci-fi manipulation, you know, something from Hollywood movie. We're talking about very sophisticated, mass scale lying, right? That's what AI, censorship, high tech, these are tools being used to lie and to manipulate, to provide truth, but only half of it, truth, but only a tenth of it, and make the tenth of it seem like 99% of it. This is how the human mind works. This is how human nature works. This is a battle for the mind, and it's a battle between good, which, yes, does exist, and evil, which, yes, does exist. And so it's amazing to me that at the end of human history, in the wealthiest nation to ever exist, in the highest technology environment that human beings have ever had, it comes down to your mind. And it comes down to guarding your mind, discerning, thinking critically, not only about the pixels that Google displays to you on your screen, but to the voices you hear over the radio, right? Thinking critically, making a choice for yourself, and not even accepting your own biases, your own wrong ways of thinking, but insisting on finding the truth. And if you're listening to Trumpet Hour, you've got to consider that the source of the truth is not you or me or any of the panelists or anybody on the street or anybody in your family or any fast-talking, handsome, charismatic cable news host. The truth comes from only one source. You've got to find it, and it's going to come from a source higher up than a radio host or a cable news host. It's going to come, I submit to you, from the Bible. That's all the time we have for Trumpet Hour this week. We appreciate you emailing us your thoughts on the program at letters@thetrumpet.com. We want to thank our panel of trumpet writers for their trumpet writing, but also for contributing here to the Week in Review edition of Trumpet Hour. Richard Palmer, Mihailo Zekic, Andrew Miller, and this week, Rafaro Manyepa joining us. Thanks to Parker Campbell for engineering and production. And thank you for listening to, for thinking critically about the Week in Review here on Trumpet Hour. We look forward to being back with you on our next episode.